Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.
So, maybe to review a few highlights. Maha, maka, does not mean big as opposed to small. Uchiyama Roshi says it means the reality of life, or one mind, or all. We have a commentary in English by Uchiyama Roshi in this essay, in his book, Deepest Practice, Deepest Wisdom. And prajna in Sanskrit is something like premium, primo, prime, knowing. Premium, or as Mike coined the term, high octane knowing. And Hakuin Zenji has a commentary on the Heart Sutra also, and his take on prajna, primo knowing, primary knowing. Bhakawin's prajna, he says, all people have it without exceptions. It's flawlessly perfect in each one of us. But Buddha, coining this term, prajna paramita, he plays around with mud pies like this. When is he going to stop? And even though this prajna is flawlessly perfect in each one of us, Hakuin says, we never see it until our fingers let go from the edge of the cliff. It's here all the time, this primary knowing, but we don't appreciate it without releasing our fingers that are holding onto the edge of the cliff and dropping. And paramita, Hakuin says, means to cross over to the other shore. But where is that? Hakuin says. When Buddha speaks this way, he's digging himself into a hole to get at the blue sky. And Koto Sawaki Roshi on the word paramita defines it as a way of life in which we have reached the point we have to reach. What paramita means. And clear seeing is prajna. And to expound and manifest this teaching, it just says to expound. What Dogen throws in the word genjo, one of his favorite words there, to expound and manifest Genjo, this teaching. Remember, this was written several months before Dogen wrote the Genjo Koan. So he's kind of warming up his Genjo term before writing a whole essay about it. It's said in the Mahaprajnaparamita Heart Sutra that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. That's like the primo knowing of the primo knowing crossing over sutra. Emptiness is it such a essential teaching in the Bodhisattva path. And yet, how can we come to understand it? So this is a little exercise we could try out, a little experiential exercise while having tea. I think Patrick's maybe experienced this exercise before in Santa Cruz many years ago. I'm going to make some marks on this piece of paper. And the exercise, I'm going to do it so you can see. While I'm making these marks, just carefully watch your mind and watch how your mind tries to make it into something. And then maybe at a certain point, your mind kind of like has made something of it. I can watch this tendency that I think is happening maybe all day long in different ways. The mind is, without even noticing it, trying to sort of get a hold of things and give meaning to things and make something of things. And it does so very easily. But this is sort of slowing down the process to see if you can kind of catch the mind. This, see if you can see this on the screen here. Can you see your mind like kind of like solidifying lines into meaning? That's all. Yeah, do you see like angular lines looking like maybe an arrow point, and then all it takes is one extra line and you get this letter. And by the way, I forgot to mention when we were talking this morning about the Prajnaparamita Sutras come in all these different lengths, 100,000 line, 25,000, 10,000, down to 300 in the Diamond Sutra, down to the Heart Sutra. But actually the Heart Sutra is not the shortest Prajnaparamita. There's a Prajnaparamita Sutra in one letter in ancient India, and it's this one. Other Sanskrit looks different from English, but is Prajnaparamita in one letter. So it can get really, really short. But maybe nobody, because I haven't mentioned that before, when you saw that, you didn't, oh, it's Prajnaparamita. And maybe when you saw Ta, you didn't remember that this morning I mentioned it. Makahanya Haramitsu is missing the Ta. And the sutra is Makahanya Haramita. And Dogen left out the Ta. And then it could be like Iya, but then that like horizontal line completely changes it. So I find this really interesting. I don't know if you kind of grok the kind of point of this exercise, but seeing how just a few little lines suddenly congeals into a meaningful symbol. And then we see like the letter A, and then we have various associations, like it's the first letter in the alphabet. For me, I maybe think of it's Prajnaparamita, one letter. And then all this conceptual meaning that goes with that. And not only is there meaning, but we're talking about emptiness here, that things appear a certain way, and we feel like they have some essence, like there really is something to it. So I feel like as soon as that horizontal line crosses the peak and makes the letter A, I feel kind of naturally that it really is the letter A. It's not just three lines anymore. Can you follow that? There's a difference between just three lines that is kind of like could be anything, that have this potential to mean anything and be anything. Somehow, like seeing that shape, I really feel like there's an essential A-ness to this picture. It really is the letter A. It's not just three lines. It's like an A with everything that comes with an A. The essential nature of A is immediately present, and the three lines come together.
It's self-nature.
Yeah, it feels like it has self-nature. It feels like the A has its own self-nature, its own being, its own essence. Whereas really we saw how it was created gradually. It's just three lines arranged in a certain way, but the mind wants to make some self-nature out of everything and easily does so without any effort.
Is that, it's part of that we're like almost doing math in our mind using all of the contextual data that we already have on the situation. So like what I know about you, what I know about where I am at times, like all this information that I've just kind of got running in the background based on what I already know. And then, you know, but then every single thing that I see, I'm kind of computing, categorizing based on the contextual information that I have.
Yeah, exactly. Like there's a kind of programming going on in the background, or the math program is calculating unconsciously, usually. Sometimes it's somewhat conscious, but it's just going along and creating our version of reality, as Mike used the word this morning. Impute meaning onto things. Something like that. When we were talking about impulses, something like that. How we
conceptual imputation,
we project meaning onto things without even knowing it. Just from a little bit of data, like three lines, there is an A. Yeah. So, like math.
I say too that we're very, very fast at it. We're so fast we don't even know what we're doing.
Yeah, we don't know it. So, yeah.
Reconstruct the world.
Mm-hmm. Reconstructing the world. And it works pretty well as a functional thing to have tea and stuff like this. But then the Buddha is saying on this, bring at this more profound kind of level of teaching, where he's saying that we're naturally doing this, but things really aren't the way they appear. We're imputing meaning and essence, self-nature, to everything. This is just a simple example. the self nature of a letter A. It's like, it's already not much. It's just a symbol, but we really feel like there's something there. But then we can take this simple example and apply it to like Zendo. We put together, you know, an altar with a Buddha on it, a bunch of black cushions, and quiet atmosphere, and maybe some other things. And then we really feel like it is the Zendo. And we walk into it and we really feel, I am in the Zendo. And if someone were to ask, well, is it really a Zendo? I'd say, well, yeah, it really is. And that's where we can question, you know, how many elements of the Zendo could we start taking away before it stopped being a Zendo? You could take away the altar. Like there are Zendos these days that don't have a Buddha on an altar. They have a rock or something. Or if you take away that centerpiece and just have cushions, yeah, it's still a Zendo. If you take away all the Zafus and Zavatams and maybe the kind of like shoji screen doors, maybe cover them up, and you have this nice floor but no altars or cushions or Japanese aesthetics, then you might walk into it, if you didn't know it was Jikoji, and really might not think anymore that it's a Zendo. Right? If you put some people sitting on the floor in upright posture, then maybe instantly it would become, oh, it's a Zendo. But this is just to say that this room really doesn't have like self nature of a Zendo. It's just a collection of stuff temporarily coming together, creating the appearance and function of a Zendo, but it doesn't really have the essential essence of a Zendo. It's not, the Zendo is not a permanent, singular, independent entity, that it will always be a Zendo no matter what. One time it was a school. Mm-hmm. In the future, maybe it'll be something else. And before the final line was crossed on this A, it maybe was like a close-up of a pencil tip or a teepee or a very steep mountain or something. And even when you put the last cross line on it, it still doesn't really have the essence, the singular, permanent, independent self nature of the letter A. Somebody who didn't know the English language, this kind of character, wouldn't think that it's an A at all. A pencil tip, an elf hat, a Christmas tree with one garland of tinsel. Yes.
Like you're kind of saying that we construct things out of the attributes of things in a certain sense, right?
Yeah, or like collections of different attributes. Yeah, could be attributes and parts. Mm-hmm. Like this has, you know, this is just one angled part and another angled part. Not exactly attributes, but other things, like a Zendo example, is kind of attributes things.
Could there still be sort of the idea of a Zendo without those attributes, without the Zendo itself? In other words, like we know apples are red, but if there were no apples around, would there still be redness? Would redness exist? Hmm. If there was nothing red.
Or do you mean like
I'm trying to figure out where you're going.
Do you mean like if we don't see an apple? I mean, we can imagine a red apple, right? And then we could ask, is that a real apple that we're imagining?
No, I'm thinking of more like ideal attributes that don't have anything associated with a specific object.
The red without an apple.
Red without an apple.
Yeah.
Is that conceivable? I mean, well, we can see of it.
Yeah, well, I think that like there could be a field of color without knowing what it is. Maybe, definitely in the visual sense of, or the visualized sense. Right? You can close your eyes and visualize just a field of redness and almost see it. Well, it's not direct perception, but we know what red looks like, so we can kind of visualize this field of red, and that would be like just the attribute without any object. And maybe if you like woke up lying in a field and open your eyes to a cloudless sky, the first moments of waking up from the nap, you might be like, there's nothing but just blue. I don't know what it is. But then pretty quickly, if we looked around, oh, it's the sky.
Sounds like a Rothko painting.
Larry says, sounds like a Rothko painting. Yeah, we don't know what that is, right? But, and then there's also this issue of generic things that we imagine that we maybe attribute less reality to a visualized apple than an apple that we see. We think one's the imagination and one's a direct sense perception. But the Prajnaparamita Sutras are saying, actually, they're kind of getting very similar from a Prajnaparamita perspective. They're both projected. That's hard for us to take, because we attribute more to sensory perception than to just mere imagination. Prajnaparamita is asking us to consider, well, maybe even the sensory perception is somewhat imagined or projected. If, for example, people are colorblind, they would actually see this sensory object differently than someone viewing colors. So all this is a way to look at this word emptiness, so that what was the letter A here is empty of itself, empty of being the letter A, empty of truly existing as the letter A, but still appearing and functioning as the letter A. So we say form itself is emptiness. We can say the form of the letter T is emptiness, because it's empty of some essential T-ness, but it also is form in the sense that it appears and functions as the letter T. So in that example, the kind of practical, maybe simple way to hear this radical statement that form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself is form. There's no difference between them. This is one letter T. And from a certain perspective, it is the form of the letter T. And from another perspective, it is totally empty of essentially existing T, or self nature of T, own being of T. Yeah, they could perceive, if they didn't know what a certain object was, like if they had never seen anything like it, then they would really have a different perspective. Yeah.
It's red.
Yeah.
Round.
Yeah.
Growing on a tree.
Yeah. If someone had never seen any fruit at all, mm-hmm. then they would really wonder what it was, maybe. It's hard to think of examples because people just get so used to things being like other things.
Yeah, true.
But also, all the associations we have with the plum, like this morning we're talking about, there's sensations of pleasant and unpleasant. Some people like plums and some don't like plums. So they could be looking at it and still identifying it as a plum, but one is thinking of it as something really great. Like a weed is an example that I think is going around Jikoji as a the bait of like weeds or something to get rid of versus weeds are these beautiful plants that are to be honored and respected. So it's just, you know, they might still agree that they're on something, something is called a weed officially, but our, you know, relationship to it. So it's empty of a weed as something negative. Mm-hmm. Weed is not necessarily a derogative term, derogatory term.
One person's weed could be a person's medicine.
Yeah, exactly. So it's empty of a certain way of being a weed that we assume all weeds are. And going even deeper and further into this, it's putting aside whether weeds are good or bad, it's not even really a weed at all. And this has to do with language, the way we put in, overlay names onto things like weed. We really don't know what it is. The deeper we go into this, it's not, it doesn't have a singular, permanent, independent essence as a weed. It's just a collection of different qualities and parts temporarily coming together in a way that we can attribute meaning to it. So as the Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And then Dogen takes it another step that is not said in the sutra. Dogen says, form is form, emptiness is emptiness. And we might think like, well, duh. isn't that obvious? But what point might he be making there? Maybe, like Dogen says elsewhere, a few months later in the Genjo Koan, Dogen says, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. So when we're in the perspective of form, like this is the letter T. It's functioning as a letter T. It's the first sound of the syllable ta. That's what it is. That's like form is form. We're just, when that side is illuminated, the emptiness side is dark. It's not done. We don't need emptiness when we're trying to have function. And, but then we can see, actually, it's just two lines. There's actually no real T there. It's just two lines put together in a certain way that could also be like, a dead end street, like coming off of another street and a road map from above. And, it would have a totally different function and meaning. So, a picture of the painting of the horizon with a very straight river running towards us. Not very good perspective. A stop sign seen from the side, upside down. So that's kind of now this is more like the emptiness perspective, right? It's like, oh, I don't know what it is. It's all these different things and none of them are more valid or real than any other. They're all equally valid and they're all equally wrong and equally right. Like that's more kind of the emptiness side. So when that side is illuminated, the side of functioning just as the letter T, that side's dark. So it's hard to be in both perspectives at once, right? Of form and emptiness, even though both are true, we kind of switch back and forth. Just like there's another good example for this kind of thing is those optical illusions where you see, you know, two faces or a vase. Probably everybody's seen that kind of thing. You know, you can see these two profile faces, if you look at it like that, or you can shift the perspective and you just see a vase, a kind of decorated vase. But it's very hard to see them at the same time. So when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. Maybe this is why Dogen says, after saying form is emptiness, emptiness is form, and that form is form. Form is just form. And emptiness is emptiness. And also, we could say that it's not exactly a dualistic statement to say that form is emptiness, because it's like the heart of the Heart Sutra. And yet, if we're getting really picky about words, we could say you have these two different words. So that in itself is dualistic in the sense that you're using two terms for the same thing. Why are you splitting reality into form and emptiness? So to address the duality of using these two terms for one reality, we can just say form is form. There's no duality there. Form is form and emptiness is emptiness. This is one reality. That makes sense? So these are various ways we could look at why Dogen brings up this issue of form is form and emptiness is emptiness. Oh, Larry, yes.
I know that's it, the sutras always say when one side is dark, the other side is illuminated. We have many sutras that say that. And I understand that, but sometimes I have the sense, perhaps while sitting zazen and perhaps in other off the cushion, sometimes I have the sense that maybe both, a little of both is going on at the same time. And, far be it from me to question, 2,500 year sutras and teachings, but, I'm just curious your thoughts about that, because, for instance, Suzuki Roshi has said in some of his lectures, you want to bring big mind into your everyday life. And, and I have that perception. So I'm just curious of your thoughts.
Yes. As I mentioned, it's hard to see both perspectives at the same time, but it's wonderful when a little bit or a lot we can actually have a sense of both sides, at least a little of each. I think sometimes it's said in the sutras that only a completely awakened Buddha can completely realize both these truths and kind of function completely in both of these truths, emptiness and form, simultaneously. So in one sense, we might say, it seems like it's very hard to have both. In another sense, it seems like, well, aren't they always both for everybody, actually? So they are, but to fully appreciate both sides. But yes, in meditation is one of the cases where I think it's possible to access a little of each. The problem, if we were really say driving a car and really kind of deconstruct the car and the car is coming towards us and all, fully, it would be very dangerous. We shouldn't try that while driving. But to have the sense of, it really is like that, to have some sense of that, but we're more engaged in the functioning of driving at that time. But even then, when we're really engaged in the practical activity of driving, or we're focusing on the form side, and the emptiness side of that is a little bit dark, we can still remember it and kind of appreciate it without it becoming dangerous. I know that I'm constructing all this and I better keep constructing it to not have an accident, but also I know that it's a kind of virtual reality. So, but Zazen's good for it's not so dangerous to open to both sides. And you're right that many teachings bring up this point when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark, like the Sando Kai comes to mind. Right and light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. Right? In darkness, there is light, but don't see it as light. It's almost like admonishing us to not get distracted by the other side. Yeah. Kind of funny, like that.
But to know it's there.
Yeah, but to know it's there. And then we have one sentence right after the other, and both are true. And maybe that's a little bit of the feeling of Dogen saying form is form and emptiness is emptiness. Don't get conceptually distracted by trying to drive the car, but what about the emptiness here? It would be kind of a distraction to try to find some other side. And maybe occasionally it's vice versa, like we're sitting really deeply and our kind of constructed world maybe disintegrating to some extent. Right? And it's very spacious and freeing. We're not trying to hold anything together. At that time, don't try to hold it together. There's a temptation. Well, maybe one way of holding it together at that time is let's try to capture this and pin it down and get a conceptual description of it so that when Zazen's over, I can tell someone about it or tell myself about it. You know, I got to try to remember this in a way that's kind of like getting into the unilluminated side rather than just be it and then don't try to take home any party favors. From Zazen, something like that. So form is form, emptiness is emptiness. And in the Heart Sutra, we say, shiki soku zei ku, ku soku zei shiki. The soku zei means like, in itself is form, shiki. Soku zei, like, is exactly ku, and ku is exactly shiki. So the soku zei is this compound that means like, itself is, or this very form is emptiness. So just, in this part of Dogen, he kind of splits, he likes playing with language like this. He splits the soku and the zei, which have almost the same meaning. So his would read, this would be shiki zei shiki ku zei ku. Form is form, empty itself, empty. So it's just part of his wordplay. It's hard to capture in English. And form is form, emptiness is emptiness. 100 grasses are thus myriad forms, or here it's a different word, form. It's like more like images, myriad images are thus. And 100 grasses is just one of the Zen terms for like the myriad things, all the individual particulars are thus, meaning, are just form from one perspective and are just emptiness from another. Then the manifestation of 12-fold prajna. And again, manifestation, as we missed this morning, is Kaz Tanahashi's and Ed Brown's translation of paramita. And it's not quite really the meaning of prajnaparamita, but it's anytime they say manifestation here, it's really the perfection or the transcendence of the 12-fold prajna. And then in parentheses, the prajna of the 6 senses and their objects means 12 types of entering, let's say, into Buddha Dharma, or maybe more like the 12 entrances where experience happens, would be another way of looking at entering. So prajna, basically, 12-fold prajna paramita is the 12 ayatana in Sanskrit, the six sense faculties and the six sense objects. So this is basically now going through these lists of the Heart Sutra that cover the five aggregates, the five skandhas are all empty in the Heart Sutra, and in Dogen's take on it, the five aggregates are prajna. They are primo knowing. And here, now we take the next list from the Heart Sutra. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, and object of mind. The 12 ayatanas, which means like the fields, 12 fields or 12 bases of experience, is another model of Buddha taught of all-encompassing experience of body, mind, and world. This morning we talked about five aggregates. Every possible experience of body, mind, and world is contained in the five aggregates. So it's an all-inclusive presentation of experience. Everything can fit into that. This is just another version. The Buddha played with different types. He said, I teach these for different people because some are like, wow, that really rings true. Five aggregates is everything. Some people are like, I don't know. Then the Buddha taught 12 fields is everything. Now, in this case, he skips like, you know, feeling and conception and karmic impulses. He leaves them off the list, but they would fit into the objects of mind category. So they're just different categorizations of all-encompassing experience. And here Dogen's just saying these 12 realms of experience is 12-fold prajna. 12-fold true knowing that everyone has. And maybe it's a good chance to mention that one way of looking at this, why he keeps saying all these things are prajna instead of saying that they're emptiness, it's a more positive way of talking. All these things are knowing, are this kind of primary, premium kind of knowing or understanding is... One way of looking at this is that with these 12, for example, like the eye is a kind of knowing. The eye knows things, the ear knows things, the tongue knows, and body are knowing faculties. That's how we know the world, is through these six sense faculties. Then when we get through color, sound, smell, taste, touch, we think, well, those aren't types of knowing. Why would you call red and dog bark these objects? Why would you call them prajna or primary knowing? And one way to look at that is if we examine very carefully a color, looking at the color of the wall, and we feel like it's an object out there, but actually if we look very carefully and open-mindedly and unbiasedly in zazen or out of zazen, we can maybe start to open to the possibility that the color that we're seeing is actually knowing itself. In other words, it is the mind. And the sounds that we're hearing are not external vibrations in the air. That's one story about them. But experientially, the sounds that we're hearing are actually the knowing of them. If there's no sound in addition to the knowing of it, there's no colors in addition to the knowing of it, there's no tastes and smells in addition to knowing of them. Experientially, it seems to be the case. And we imagine, well, for us, it's just our experience. But there really is a sight, a color, and a sound apart from the knowing of it. Also, we usually might feel that way and think that way because the scientists tell us this kind of thing and so on. But experientially, I find it quite interesting that we actually can't find any colors or sounds other than knowing of them. We'll never be able to, no matter how good technology becomes and how advanced the instruments that measure color and sound become. All the data from the instruments is just knowing of data. So we can't go beyond this. And that's a profound understanding to at least try on. Because in this understanding, then there is nothing other than knowing is present awareness. And therefore, there's nothing outside of it or in addition to it. And therefore, there's no duality. This is one boundless, ungraspable, undivided knowing. And this is very liberating because this, as soon as there's something outside of this knowing, then it's problematic, actually. then it's something good or bad that we want more of or less of. There's me in relationship to it. It's maybe could harm me or benefit me. There's me and the world. And this whole setup is the usual setup, but it's a kind of painful setup. And there's no real evidence for it being that way.
It's like you can't know something outside of knowing.
That's right, right. So we could say it most simply as the instruction is know that knowing knows only knowing. Knowing knows only knowing, but we have to know that.
I understood everything until you just said that, and now I'm like... No, I'm totally
knowing this present knowing. This is knowing right now. We're sharing knowing. So, and this knowing, what does it know? It was at first we think it knows colors and sounds and stuff, but we look deeper and we say those colors and sounds are nothing other than knowing. So knowing knows only knowing. So it's hard, but to understand that we have to know this. So we have to know. The knowing knows, only knowing. That's amazing. You know it.
Can I run by what I think I understand?
Sure. Sure.
Or maybe the purpose of what Dogen's trying to say too is that we are limited by the senses that we were given. And that's the only way of really interfacing with reality around us or what we perceive to be reality around us. So you may as well embrace that because it's not going anywhere anytime soon. There's science, there's information outside of you, objects outside of you, but all you can really trust fully is your own knowing of what you're perceiving through all of these different senses and through your mind and just that whole combination of world, senses, and mind and how it's all computing at any given moment. So you may as well embrace it and love it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's that's nicely put.
That's okay.
And then we could take it even further when you said all we know is our own knowing, our own sensing. But again, one of the implications of this, if we look very carefully, and we, if we say there is like the sense of me, Tokyo, being like a knowing center, because my eyes and ears are all located here, but actually just the primo knowing, the premium, high octane, unleaded knowing is kind of prajna, transcendent knowing that's gone beyond. You could say this one, even the sense of like me as the center knower, is just another type of knowing. Yeah. In other words, the sense of Kokyo is actually another object of knowing. Kokyo thinks of himself as Kokyo. And Kokyo, we thought of as the perceiver, but actually, if we look carefully, it's perceived. Kokyo is a perception of this knowing. So when we say, there is this knowing, what I'm trying to get at is that this knowing may be not actually just personal, individual. There is, of course, that sense. We're all seeing a different image of the room. But if we get to the premium, prime, prior kind of knowing, that knowing with the prior to content, or, you know, that which is just the raw knowing of any content, would be exactly the same for each of us, for everyone in the room, that the basic knowing would be exactly the same. The particulars are different, of course, for all of us. The particular and the objective projections are different, but just knowing itself, being itself, awareness itself, we can't find anything to distinguish between my knowing and your knowing. If we find anything to distinguish it, that distinguishing characteristic, I would say, is now in the category of the objects, the particulars of experience. Like you're seeing this face and I'm seeing that face, but the knowing of this face and the knowing of that face, we could say that basic knowing is identical. This is, we could explore this because it's a profound principle and it flies in the face of our intuition. So we can really look deeply and what do we mean by the most basic knowing? And if it's something that we really can't get a hold of, it is just like light, like space, then that would be the same for exactly the same for each of us. And that's where we're not separate at all. The content will always be separate. Our thoughts will be separate. Our perceptions are different. But the basic knowing could be what we all share and what connects us most deeply. Not even really connects us, because it is just one reality that we are. So that's why if we know that knowing knows only knowing, and then there's no separation. Yes.
So help me in these first few paragraphs. You've been talking about this prime knowing, and also went into pretty good detail of form is emptiness, emptiness form, or form empty, empty. How does that all go together? You know, because on one level we could think that prime knowing is really always being aware mm-hmm. that we're a collection of parts.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And yet... Which is the emptiness mm-hmm. side. And, but then this prime knowing
particulars.
Well, no, this prime knowing that you described as we're actually even seeing ourselves as objects.
Yeah, yeah.
There's this sort of awareness that is always sort of saying, you know, I'm always seeing this profile whenever I open my eyes.
Yeah, or even if I think about myself, that's objects. We think I'm the subject thinking about myself, but actually, there isn't really a subject unless we say the subject in this case, we could say, is the one we all share. The subject is the contentless knowing, and any particulars about ourself as a perceiver or something or a subject falls into the category actually of object if we look carefully. In other words, any thoughts about ourself is objective content, right? Of knowing.
So I'm identifying myself over and over again. In the same way that every time I see those three lines in that configuration,
yeah.
I also come up with a perception.
Yeah.
Those three lines are A, this profile is Patrick.
Yeah. The physical profile, or the visual one, right? But also so many mental profiles we have of ourselves. And exactly the same as this. You know, the three lines example is just so simple. But if we apply that to our individual personness, it's so complex, right? And it's so deep. I mean, this is like we have to learn about A's at some point. But I think infant children, before they're even taught anything, at some point start to have a kind of self-consciousness of being a kind of individual. I think we get taught a lot of it, and we don't know exactly what this is like, but I can imagine that infants start just by negotiating the relationship with an apparent world. They start to form a sense of subjectivity, individual subjectivity. But from this perspective of the knowing that we all share, the individual subjectivity is kind of an objectivity. It's kind of objective content. Makes sense.
Where we're kind of coloring how we're even perceiving things as a subject, turning ourselves into a part of that equation. An object, labeling the labels that we have for ourselves within color how we're totally everything around us.
Yeah, we make ourselves into objects. It's the primary object that we make, actually, and the one that we're most concerned with, too.
Yeah, we judge.
We're really good at it. And often, we usually have some problems with it too. I mean, you could say we make a self that we don't like, or even if we make one that we really love, it's the opposite extreme is just as bad in the end. And we just get arrogant about it. I am the best.
That self against another construct.
So just knowing that it's all constructed and then what is there? So Dogen, you know, the Heart Sutra is just emphasizing that none of this is really the way we think it is. That's the emptiness side. And Dogen, it seems like all through this essay in various ways, it's a common theme actually of Dogen is trying to undermine kind of nihilistic views of emptiness that are just negating. And I think he's doing that in his early career. It's like the first thing he wrote. And you find this all through Dogen's teaching, saying that everything is actually it. So here he's saying all these things that the Heart Sutra tells us don't exist. Dogen says all the same lists of things are now called prajna, or knowing. It's a kind of, and knowing, you could say, is another name for emptiness. To go back to Patrick's question, how does this all fit together? I think we could say it's another name for emptiness, but it's a very different sounding one. This knowing, if this knowing is boundless, ungraspable, indescribable, ultimately, in its nature, devoid of any particular content. All those are kind of descriptions of emptiness. but it's not a mere negation. It's not a nothingness. It's a more like an everythingness, if we talk about it as knowing. Because this knowing that we're all sharing right now is filled with Zendo and cushions and people and ideas and feelings and tastes of strawberries and all that. What is this knowing of strawberries and Zendos? I don't know what it is. None of us know what it is, right? It's totally ungraspable. And yet it's palpably present. I think that's kind of the theme of this essay. So then Dogen's taking all the classic lists, 12 ayatana, these sense chakras and sense objects, and saying that's 12-fold prajna. It's 12-fold knowing. Then he continues, then there's an 18-fold prajna. And just like the Heart Sutra says, the sutra says, no eyes, no ears, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, down to no realm of mind consciousness, something like that. And that's an abbreviation for these six consciousnesses that go with the six senses. So it's an 18-fold. It's another list of Buddha. Might say, well, it's basically the same, but he liked lists. basically the gist there is that there's an eye and a color, but there's also what's called an eye consciousness, chakshura vijnana, that kind of connects the eye and the color. There's a sense consciousness. So there's six consciousnesses in the early Buddhist model for each of the six senses. And then the later Yogacara model adds in like the storehouse consciousness. It's like where all this stuff is happening. And the manas, which is like the sense of personal self, the sense of being an independent entity. And this Yogacara system is called the seventh consciousness. It's so important, this false projection of being an independent self, that it gets called a type of consciousness in the Yogacara system. But here we're just dealing with early Buddhist system, 18-fold prajna. As Dogen says also, the corresponding consciousness of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Then there's the fourfold noble truth prajna, suffering, really origination of suffering, cessation of suffering, and the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Like the Heart Sutra says, no suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path, the Four Noble Truths. And there aren't any Four Noble Truths in the Heart Sutra, but in this essay, it's called the fourfold prajna, the fourfold knowing. So it's the same principle through all these lists, but we could apply it individually and say, well, you know, meditating on the Four Noble Truths is so central to Buddha's message. Or we could take a suffer. What is suffering? Buddha was really into trying to understand what is suffering. And one of his early descriptions of suffering was just any kind of like grasping, mental fixation is like the definition of suffering, or dukkha, discontent. What is discontent? It's when we're really holding on to something. And aversion is another kind of holding on, actually. Another kind of grasping, fixation. Get away from it or get more of it. That's the early definition of suffering. But here, and then the Heart Sutra's definition of suffering is you can't actually find it, right? It's just a bunch of stuff put together that we call suffering. It's a mental fabrication. But here, Dogen calls suffering a type of prajna, type of like pure knowing. understanding, pure knowing, we could say, what is this? I feel this, this painful, icky kind of clenched, fixation on some, on an idea of myself or something like this. We could say, there's dukkha. But what is it really when we look very carefully? It's just the knowing of this icky conglomeration of fixation. There's, in other words, there's no fixation other than pure knowing of fixation. Yeah. And the same with the cessation of suffering. There's also, oh, this is nirvana, the complete cessation of suffering. There's no nirvana other than the knowing of nirvana. This is the fourfold noble prajna. And there's also the sixfold prajna, which is the six paramitas. That's not actually in the Heart Sutra. So Dogen's just pulling in some other classic lists, the six paramitas or transcendences. Generosity, giving, ethical conduct, patience, diligence, meditative concentration, and primo knowing paramita, prajna paramita. But actually, he's saying here, they're all prajna, not just prajna is prajna, but giving is prajna. When there's really some, me giving you something is just like, is normal giving. And then for it to be a paramita of giving, that would be like when there's no sense of me and you, it's just giving is happening with no duality. That would be like the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift would be prajna, would be, dana paramita. The transcendent giving. And then Dogen's version is that transcendent giving is just the knowing of it. Prajna dana paramita. Like that. Then there's the single fold prajna paramita, which is unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment, which is mentioned in the Heart Sutra. All Buddhas rely on prajnaparamita and realize unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment. I think it keeps going through the terms of the Heart Sutra. But then Dogen adds in, this unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment is actualized at this very moment, right now. And this actualizes again, Genjo, favorite term of Dogen. The manifestation is manifested at this moment of now. Single fold knowing. So all these lists of multiple types of knowing. It's kind of nice that when we're talking about the one knowing, this is actually one single fold knowing. It's the one we all share. This one that we all share is called unsurpassed perfect enlightenment, anuttara samyak sambodhi, and it's actualized at this moment right now. This is kind of a Zen way of talking about perfect awakening, is that this is it. The only thing is, we have to know that knowing knows only knowing. I mean, knowing knows only knowing. But if we really know that in a non-dual knowing kind of way, then why not call it unsurpassed perfect awakening? Now, there is the manifestation. Actually, so now we're back to manifestation here is paramita. There's the paramita of threefold prajna. I think it actually says is the threefold Prajnaparamita, which is past, present, and future. And that's also in the Heart Sutra, right? All Buddhas of past, present, and future rely on Prajnaparamita. But it's interesting that it comes right after Dogen saying that this unsurpassed enlightenment is actualized now. It's always now. But then it's also comes in a threefold form, so-called past, present, and future. We could also say if there's a past and a future, there's no past and future other than the knowing of them. And the knowing of them is always, you know, so-called now. It's more like the timeless now, not the present that's in between the past and the future, but the now that never changes.
Kokyo, it does seem like Dogen's kind of applying prajna, like across the board.
Yeah, right? Across the board.
It doesn't come to mind that prajna itself being applied sort of like in a broadcast way like this. Kind of makes it a kind of absolute or something outside the system, you said?
Outside the system, like that. Like, it manages to escape from the system.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of an absolute. I think he's talking about it that way. And in fact, I think Prajnaparamita Sutras would also consider Prajnaparamita to be a kind of absolute outside the system. Yeah, I think the sutras are already going that way, and Dogen's kind of riffing on that in his own way. Outside the system, meaning outside all these lists of systematic lists of mental phenomena, you could say it's outside that those systems, but you could also say it's more like the container of all those systems.
Or just outside conventional conceptual reality.
Yeah. Again, outside it, or it's like space that can manifest within itself all the conventional systems. Later, Dogen will bring up the space, which I think is just a great metaphor for talking about the Prajnaparamita. If there's a knowing right now that has no characteristics, even as it's knowing all characteristics of things, it itself has no characteristics. That's like space, like the space that's filling the room. You can't get a hold of it. It has no color or shape or size. And it also it has no boundaries, space, right? It doesn't have any edges. You can put walls up within the space, delineate inside the space in the Zendo and outside the Zendo, but the space isn't bounded by the walls of the Zendo. It's just everywhere. And you could even say the space allows a Zendo to be built within it. That's like this primo kind of knowing. It allows every experience to be built within it. Without, and the experiences built within it don't hinder it. Just like the Zendo doesn't.
Call it the generosity.
Totally. Generosity of the absolute is not cramped at all by a Zendo being built there. And even if someone were to take a hammer and start hitting space, space would not mind. Right? It wouldn't complain. So knowing is kind of like that. It can't be damaged. And it also can't be improved, and it can't be gotten a hold of. It can't be limited. It can't be destroyed, but it also can't be born. So it's space, physical space is a wonderful metaphor, because not only is it physically boundless, it is temporarily timeless. Right? Space doesn't like gradually evolve. And so it's a really great metaphor. It's time, space is timeless, boundless. It allows everything and it's always at peace. It can't be disturbed. Very, very good metaphor, I think, for prajna, premium knowing. And that's another, so many angles on why this is so, such a wonderful teaching, this type of primal knowing, is that maybe the most important quality in a way is that it doesn't suffer. While we, sentient beings, in it, are suffering and projecting problems and projecting joys and concerns, the space of knowing is always the same. So we say it's isn't that just kind of neutral? It's not like happy or sad, you know, pure knowing. And we could say, yeah, but neutral is pretty good in this sense, right? Neutral is like non-discriminating and total peace. The neutral quality of ordinary awareness is completely free from suffering by its very nature.
In its very nature, space allows for things to exist within it, around it. It seems like it's almost inherently positive.
We could call that neutral positive. It's interesting. I mean, this is the territory of, I would understand, this kind of Zen-like understanding of prajna, or this perfect knowing, is kind of like a synonym for the Buddhist teachings of like nirvana, which sometimes the Buddha talked about. It's just peace. It's just the absence of discontent. It's contentment. But sometimes he called it like bliss, like ananda, words like this. And maybe both have their virtues. To call it bliss maybe attracts people like, I want to practice that. If you just call it like neutral, like, yeah. But so it's maybe. So it could be that. I think this is Buddhist skillful means for some people who are really like caught up in looking for some bliss or something. Then maybe it's wants them to just cool down. Actually, nirvana is peace, and isn't that actually the best, even better than any kind of bliss that would be impermanent? But we could also say the absence of any kind of discontent is subtly blissful. And a miracle here is that the proposal of these kinds of teachings, I think, is that this is our nature, is this way, and it's only just temporarily hidden by our just habitual fixation on the content of experience. The content of knowing. There's also the sixfold prajna. This one's not in the Heart Sutra. Earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. So the Mahabhuta, the four great elements that make up humans and also make up the world. Earth, water, fire, air, and then I think in the Mahayana teachings they add in space because they love it and consciousness, interestingly. So you could say that's another all-encompassing list. You could say all, if you include consciousness, then all experience and all phenomena are encompassed by these six elements. And actually, earth, water, fire, and air are nothing other than the knowing of them. They're nothing but prajna. The fourfold bodily posture, prajna, is walking, standing, sitting, and lying down, common in daily activities. So there's no sitting in addition to the knowing of sitting. There's no walking other than the knowing of walking in our experience. Is it not the case? It's just counterintuitive. We think, no, this is sitting. It really is like when you put a body in this posture, it really is sitting. It has that essential self nature of sitting. No, not really, but there is the knowing of this experience we call sitting. There's no experience that we can ever find other than just experiencing. Is another way to put this. Experience is kind of like a noun. Experience is space congealed into a particular event. We call an experience of sweet, sour, loud, quiet, pleasant, unpleasant. But actually, all these experiences, we could call these all these dharmas in Abhidharma system types of experience. But we can't really find any particular experience, really, if we look carefully, other than experiencing. So experiencing is another name for knowing. Each of us is having a different experience right now, but the experiencing of it, I would propose, if you look carefully, could be the exact same experiencing. There's only one experiencing, and it manifests, expresses itself as infinite types of experiences. Yeah? Verb and anything in language is a little bit problematic, but the verb is a little better than the noun, but a verb still implies something's that experiencing is like something is happening, but I would understand this experiencing, this knowing, to be like it's not really something happening like through time. It's a, this experiencing that we're talking about is more like an unchanging experiencing in the sense that it's always identical. And any differences we could find in it would be the content. So what we call time, the movement of time, is like content of the unchanging experiencing. Like space. All this stuff is content in space. So that's all many folded prajna. Is there anything to clarify about this? Anybody in space over there? The space of the screen or the space of the room? Have anything?
I just have a question about what you want to suggest about Zazen after this kind of talk. And where does the Zazen go?
Yeah. Great question. I mean, how might we consider Zazen in light of this kind of thing? Yeah. In a way, I think just this opening to these types of teachings is a kind of zazen, and maybe, you know, maybe as you listen to it, there's some feeling for it, and then it's really nice when Kokyo shuts up, and you can just kind of be in it without all these like extra work. Like I just got it, but then he said another sentence, and it just messed it all up. in zazen. Be like space. I think Keizan's Zazen instructions, the Zazen Yojinki, He says, be like space.
I could add that there's a saying, let zazen do zazen.
Mm-hmm.
A kind of confidence that there's a kind of base wisdom that's functioning, that's kind of supporting you in your practice. So even though your mind is moving, there's also one who's not moving, you could say, who's completely still. It's kind of a nice feeling. It's almost like you're hosting something, but you're not the host.
Zazen is the host.
Zazen is the host.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And confidence in that, as you say, and recollect. But I don't feel confidence in it. But then, so we can kind of like open to trusting it more and more. It's like, it sounds good. It makes sense on some level. And, but I have to do this zazen because it's not going to do it itself. Something like that might feel. But then more and more we trust. Yeah, that space of knowing, which the more we can trust that it's always here. If it's unchanging, it means that it can't go anywhere. We can't lose it. However totally distracted we are, how totally sleepy, how totally agitated we might be, knowing is unchanging through all of that. And it's hosting all those particular experiences. And the thing is, we're so used to, as people, we're so used to focusing on the particulars of experience. Where my right knee is a little bit off. And like,
I'd assume some kind of agency. Like,
yeah, we're doing and it. I can do it. Yeah. And it's funny because we do have some instructions, like try to sit upright, try to sit still, let your breath sink into your lower belly, relax the body, relax the mind. These are, in a way, instructions to the person, and because they're helpful. But in a way, they're kind of outer instructions to kind of align the person so that then zazen can do its work. But we can't exactly do the zazen. Yes, Larry.
So we were talking about you know, Dogen's statement that, you know, form is form. And we also all know, or, you know, many of us know that Dogen's saying to, you know, to study Buddhism is to study the self. And so what I'm interested about is to study the self. Well, how else can you study the self except through form? And, you know, right in the introductory couple of pages of that text that we're studying, that PhD dissertation, he says Dogen affirms everyday phenomena to be the locus for the realization of the non-duality of the self and the world. And is that kind of where form is form emanates into?
If form being completely form is emptiness. Right? But by Dogen saying form is form is maybe at that time just be the form completely and then emptiness is there, but don't worry about the emptiness in addition to it because form is emptiness.
The deep investigation of the form transforms itself into this or the non-duality.
Or reveals the non-duality.
Yeah.
Always the case with this non-dual knowing. I think this morning you missed the part about the whole body, the entire body. So Dogen adds in that little phrase into the heart's quote, his quote of the Heart Sutra. And it's a phrase from Ru Jing's poem about the wind bell, the whole body turning in space. But Uchiyama Roshi's comment on the whole body the whole body means that there's no separation between subject and object. So yes, but there is that, that is always the case. And also, as you said, to study the self, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. And some might understand that as, you know, Dogen uses this word self for the big self, like another name for prajna, time knowing. Another name for that is like jiko, or true self. Uchiyama usually uses it like that. But there's also the small self. You could say it's like the sense of the independent, singular, permanent entity of me being a real thing. And I think that in the Genjo Koan, that's the one that Dogen is referring to when he says, to study the Buddha way is to study the illusory independent self. Because then the next line is, to study that self is to forget that self.
Right. And so to study the small self is to what? To observe all the minutia of phenomena, right? The sense and the sense of objects that appear in our, you know, plus thought that appear in our everyday mind.
You could do it. There's infinite ways, but that would be one way in Zazen. You could get into these lists of that the Buddha taught. I think he taught for Zazen, actually. We talk about them, but I think they were meditation frameworks. In Zazen, you can be like looking at the wall and really start investigating. So there's an eye looking at this color and like really get into experientially what's going on there. That'd be one way to study, particularly study the self. You have like that feeling of like there's me looking at the wall. What is that self? And the more we study that separate self by looking for it, that'd be one version, looking for it in the five aggregates, for example, and not finding anything but these constantly changing five aggregates. Then by studying what we think is the self, we actually forget the self. In other words, we can't find it. I think what's meant by the study of the self is to forget the self. It's not there anymore. It's just whatever's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then to forget the self is to be actualized by the 10,000 things. In other words, there's only the 10,000 things happening. There's no self in addition to it. Separate self. And then we could say, and what about this big self? That is the 10,000 things as 10,000 fold prajna.
Yeah.
So yeah. So I think Zazen is, we set up the nice conditions, quiet room and a nice posture, a nice breathing, and then just open we can just let go of any of as the content of knowing keeps arising and arising. Just let go. As we let go of it, then the space in which it's happening maybe becomes more revealed. Or the other way, besides letting go of it, is to kind of just a more active approach of investigating, inquiring into. What is this? Oh, it's a zendo. It's a body sitting. No. Those are just like, that's content. What is this? What is this space that all this stuff is happening in? We can actually ask that. Knowing that we will never find, never really get a hold of the space of prajna. It's ungraspable. But by asking, what is it? Is there knowing right now? That kind of inquiry. And we kind of maybe, we open to it more, readily. These are all different kind of types of knowledge. So maybe we'll leave it here for today. That's a lot in here. Billion fold Prajna Paramita is really just, if it feels like there's a lot going on, that's you know, an undeniable appearance of things. But then you can also remember that there's actually, this is one space that itself is not going on. It's just like, it just hosts all the goings on. Goings on is about town. Yeah. I just laughed because I saw that my eye just kind of landed on this blue button on the screen here that says reclaim host. The screen doesn't have it. It says Jikoji Events is currently host. Reclaiming the host may disrupt various things, but you can click on it and you can reclaim the host. So that's a final Zazen instruction. Range your, you know, align your ears with your shoulders and your nose with your navel, and then just immediately click on the bright blue button called Reclaim Host. And this may disrupt various things here, but you're allowed to. It gives you the option.
Zoom knows everything.
I'm not going to click it now because I don't want to disrupt any of this stuff. But later when you sit down for Zazen, I'll reclaim it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.